You're listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, www.netcaucus.org.
Thank you for joining us. The room is packed, and we're excited about that. There are a few, you know, one or two seats, I think, that are still empty down towards the front. I'm honored today. My name is David Shellhase. I'm the general counsel at Salesforce.com, which is a paradigmatic cloud computing company, I think. I'm honored today to be joined by three distinguished panelists. Going down the row from my left, Alan Davidson is the head of U.S. public policy for Google, and he opened Google's Washington, D.C. office in 2005, I believe, and is both a lawyer and technologist. Is that a fair characterization?
I've completed the fall from grace, okay. Yes.
which what?
My mother would say the lawyer part was
okay.
The fall.
Okay, fair enough. Jim Dempsey is the Vice President for Public Policy at the Center for Democracy and Technology and has been with CDT for, I think, over 10 years now.
Yes.
And is a lawyer, but not a technologist. Is that also a fair characterization?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, and all the way on my left is Susie Adams, who is the Chief Technology Officer of Microsoft's Federal Civilian Unit, and as her title implies, is a technologist and, to my knowledge, not a lawyer.
Not a lawyer.
And we can all breathe a sigh of relief,
but I'm not a lawyer.
For that. I wanted to kick off today. Jim and I did a similar panel about 6 months ago on the West Coast at State of the Net West, and we kicked off by talking about a definition for cloud computing. I don't know whether the overflow attendance here means that everybody already knows what that is and is interested in it, or everybody is puzzled by it and wants to learn more. So I thought I would start just by proffering a definition that I found in the cloud, which I think is the appropriate place to do it. I went to Wikipedia and looked up cloud computing, and here's what I found. Basically, cloud computing is reliance on the Internet for satisfying the computing needs of users without them needing knowledge of, expertise with, or control over the technology infrastructure that supports them. And I think that that is a relatively vendor-agnostic, technology-agnostic, with the exception of the Internet, way to express what cloud computing is. So, you know, to us, it's services that one might think of as software services delivered over the web, without the user's direct knowledge or control of what the technology is. Does anyone have any issue with that definition or want to amplify it in any way? Or are we prepared to accept that as our definition of cloud computing for the purposes at least of this discussion?
I think it's good enough for these purposes. I think it'd be interesting to list some examples, some illustrations, because the definition itself is a little abstract and dry, but when you think about all of the ways in which data has moved off of the desktop or off of the local device and is now stored, data and software really, is now accessible, stored on the Internet and therefore accessible from any device. So Facebook, Flickr, anybody who takes their photographs off of their laptop, stores them with Flickr, huge advantages in terms of sharing, other capabilities that come with that, but your photographs are now stored on the network. Gmail, for example, a huge...
Or Hotmail.
Hotmail.
Thank you.
Any web-based... That's right, let's be...
Just saying.
Vendor agnostic.
Vendor agnostic, very good. When you think about web-based email and what that represents in terms of the storage of now, for all of us, years and years worth of email stored remotely, readily accessible, searchable, backed up, et cetera, but again, out there in the cloud. And you could go on and on in terms of others might have.
Yeah, I guess I'd like to broaden that definition just a little bit and add that really to me is the public definition of what a cloud is, and really talk a little bit also during the panel today about what private clouds look like, because we are seeing the emergence of what we call private, even hybrid clouds, some that are private and public and they're interoperating.
I think that's a great discussion to have now, actually, Susie. So if you might want to say a couple more words about what you think a private cloud is.
Oh, sure. So defining, I had the honor of moderating a panel with several very esteemed C-level executives in the federal government about 2 months ago. And I asked the same question. I said, can you define for me what a cloud is? And it was very interesting to hear what their responses were. And it really was relative to what their current roles were and what problems and challenges they were facing in their agency, anywhere from the traditional ASP model, anything outside their firewall, to, for example, DISA, saying, you know, we want to become basically and build a private cloud where all our constituents and our customers, which are basically federal government employees and the Department of Defense, can come in and then, for example, use a service such as email. Right, and be able to do this. And if you really think about some of the trends just in the industry today, and we think about what's going on with server consolidation projects that are out there, and really you're looking at big organizations and companies basically taking, you know, 30, 40 different data centers around the world and consolidating into two or three data centers geographically, what they're really doing is creating a private cloud. And then they're starting to look at how can I use these public clouds, these services that were just discussed, Hotmail, Gmail, Virtual Earth. You can think of, if we go back in time, I mean, cloud computing's been around for a fairly long time. Right? Microsoft entered the space, you know, a little over 5 years ago when we bought what we now call Hotmail and then Virtual Earth from a public perspective. But now you're also starting to see companies build software programs and just applications, line of business applications that can be, installed in a public cloud as well as installed on-premise behind a corporate firewall in what we would call a private cloud.
You know, I would just chime in to say, first of all, I agree that's a great thing to include in this conversation and discussion. We actually, last night at the kickoff discussion, the technology fair and kickoff for the conference, Google was demonstrating in conjunction with the state of Alabama something called Virtual Alabama, which is really a private cloud application. It's a geographic application where the state of Alabama has actually uploaded all sorts of geographical data that they use for first responders, and people within the state, particularly within the state government, have access to it and can use it privately. There's also a public version of it as well, and it's a great example. I would just, in terms of the general definition, I would just add two things. I wouldn't want the sort of simplicity of the definition to make people think that it can't include very complicated kinds of applications. It's not about whether the user is technically savvy or not. I think, you know, for example, Amazon's got their Apps Engine, which is becoming a very powerful tool for businesses to build their own applications, and it's really a platform or infrastructure in the cloud as opposed to some of the kinds of applications. I'd also say we shouldn't just be thinking about data being stored in the cloud. I mean, Hotmail or Gmail or Yahoo Mail, the very popular web-based mail applications, are probably the most popular user applications. They're kind of, I think, they're like the gateway drug to cloud computing. but in a lot of ways, it's about more than just storage. It can be about processing power too and applications. So, search itself, whether Yahoo's or Microsoft's or Google search, is itself in many ways a cloud computing application. We collectively store huge amounts of data. We literally use hundreds of servers, computers, to answer a typical query. It does it very quickly. We're talking about many terabytes of data. The Google search engine, I know, actually every 4 hours crawls and indexes a Library of Congress's worth of information. That kind of computing power isn't generally available on the desktop. And it's part of what's so interesting about cloud computing is that we're making available to users things, applications that they might never have been able to do themselves from their desktop or from their mobile phone, and we're providing them. It's not just about storage, it's about processing too.
So that brings up one topic, which is, why is cloud computing, why are all these people here? Why is cloud computing suddenly such a hot topic? And Jim, you and I had talked a little bit about it. It might be something new under really an old label. I don't know. I've got, and you might want to think about that, I've got a chart here that's impossible for anyone even on the panel to see, but it's a Google Trends chart that shows no meaningful number of searches on the term cloud computing until the fourth quarter of 2007, and then continual spikes up during all of 2008, and then sort of tracking down, I guess, with bad economic news in the fourth quarter, but huge spikes, and really only in the past, let's say, year and a quarter, has cloud computing been significant enough to register on Google Trends? Jim, do you think that that's because it's something brand new or because it's a new label for something old?
Well, it's a new label for something old in a way, although clearly the trend in reality, there is a real trend underway, and there really is something real about the fact that so much data storage and processing has moved to the cloud. You know, people have been talking for a while about software as a service. In a way, that's a cloud computing application. People have been talking about thin clients. The whole notion of a thin client, in part, is that little need be stored locally. I think it was in the early 90s that John Gage, formerly of Sun Microsystems, said the network is the computer, in talking about the sort of processing power of remote devices. But clearly with broadband and with mobility, the trend has accelerated so that there really is something new here, in it, at least quantitatively, in a way also qualitatively. So undoubtedly, something different is happening about the way we approach computers, computing, data, service, access to information. And, you know, for years people drew the, you know, you drew a house or a computer over here and a house or a computer over here, and then you went like this and drew the cloud, and now finally that cloud has taken on such huge significance, not only as a conduit, but as a place where something is happening.
Alan, do you want to add to that, or?
Oh.
Okay.
I'd be happy to, actually. So I would only say, you know, a couple of different things. I think Jim's got it exactly right. And, you know, there's a couple of different pieces of this accelerating trend. So the Pew Internet and American Life group, who does just such wonderful work, recently issued a paper that study they've done over the summer on cloud computing, and they found that 69% of Americans who are online are regular users of what we would call a cloud computing application. And it's not just the web mail-based applications. It's things like photo sharing or social networking services. So there's a huge number of people now using these applications. The other thing I think that has captured so much attention is just the possibilities, right? So we've just touched on, for example, mobile. You know, 3 billion people around the world now have mobile phones. For a lot of people, their first internet experiences are going to be through a mobile device. And as powerful and amazing as these mobile devices are relative to the computers we all were using 15 or 20 years ago, they are still not able to do all the things that we now expect from our computing platform. So the ability to access these cloud-based services are going to become increasingly more important. And I think I would just say it's why it's gratifying to see people here now talking about this in Washington, just as 10 years ago we needed to reorient the way we thought about our models of computing as in the policy space, right? We moved from thinking about communications as a point-to-point circuit-switched communication to a packet-based internet, you know, interactive communication. In that same way, we now need to help the policymaking community switch its model from a model where a piece of software sits on a piece of hardware on somebody's desk, and that's how computing happens, and occasionally gets a piece of data maybe from the internet or sends something to somebody else, to a model where a lot of computing and a lot of interesting things are happening off the desktop.
So I think that's a good introduction to the way we might want to constructively spend the next 5 or 10 minutes, which is talking about the perceived advantages of cloud computing over a more traditional computing model, as well as the perceived disadvantages. Because I think in the perceived advantages and the perceived disadvantages, that's where the policy debate really gets framed, and that's where things get interesting. So Susie, maybe you could spend a minute or two talking about the perceived advantages of cloud computing, and then we can all join in on the perceived disadvantages.
Okay, sure. So I guess I'm going to break it into two topics. One is from a consumer-based perspective, and then one's from the enterprise. And I think they overlap a little bit, but there's different concerns when you move to the enterprise. So let's just take consumers. I agree with some of the discussion we've already had here today that consumers are really driving this. I've seen several people here already Twittering. Is anybody doing it right now? All right, so everybody, yeah, see? So, you know, I think social computing is really driving that. I talk many times to high school kids, and most of them can type faster than they can write. I mean, they're really driving this whole social networking kind of movement. I think it is really driving the consumers to move into this, just like we talked about sharing pictures, being able to go to Virtual Earth or Google Earth, or just being on mail. I mean, most kids today have email accounts. They know how to get on and use, you know, whether it's instant messaging or Yahoo's or Google's messaging. Everybody knows how to do this, and I think that that's really driving the consumer end of this. From an enterprise perspective, I think obviously, as you know, most of the people in enterprises are also consumers, and so I think we're seeing that carry over into the enterprise. And with that, we're starting to see enterprises look at trying to lower their total cost of ownership for their line of business applications. And a lot of that mirrors kind of over the years how historically computing has grown up. And so we started at the mainframe, and if you look at how, and it probably mirrors everybody's background in this room, we started at the mainframe, we went to client-server, we kind of made the move to the web, and then we went to service-oriented architectures. And it's great today. We can build a line-of-business application that is extremely sophisticated, runs on hundreds of computers in large data centers, but it's very expensive, it's very costly. You need not rocket scientists, but highly paid professionals to be able to monitor these things. And I think the enterprise is realizing that, hey, if we can stand up an email, if we can have these types of consumer-based services in the cloud, whether there are, and there are huge privacy and security concerns, obviously, for enterprises when they move to the cloud, you know, why can't we do that in our space? Why can't we take what we're doing with server consolidation efforts in our three or four data centers in a private, you know, type of cloud, and why can't we start to leverage some of these services that folks like Microsoft and Google and Amazon have and take advantage of the economies of scale and their specialties in their data centers, right? And just from a green perspective in the cloud, bring to each enterprise.
So I'll quote a couple of surveys that I've seen, and they were taken 2 years apart. One was an Economist survey done in April 2006, and then actually 2.5 years later, Gartner did a survey. And they asked people, what are the advantages of cloud computing over traditional on-premise software? And this is in an enterprise context, and thank you, Susie, for distinguishing between the two. So this is more oriented towards businesses than consumers, but the overlap is quite remarkable. The Economist, and this is sort of in order of preference, said people prefer the cloud because it's cheaper to run, there's faster deployment, it's easier to use, it's simpler to implement, it's more likely to be actually used, and you can avoid your IT department, which is, I guess, always a value. Gartner, 2.5 years later, said it's more cost, and again, this is in order of response, more cost effective, it's easier or faster to deploy. The people who answered the survey said that they lacked IT resources to implement an on-premise solution, which is, I guess, a nice way of saying they wanted to avoid their IT department. It required a more limited capital expenditure because you can run this through your P&L, and the perceived user acceptance was much higher. And so those are the sort of business consumer reasons for adopting cloud computing. And I think we talked when we discussed our panel earlier about some other advantages that we saw in the cloud that I think are significant. And maybe we can talk for a couple of minutes about those. One is shared security. One is a shared upgrade model and the economies of scale that Susie referenced. And the third is ease of collaboration. And I think that is something that is coming over from the consumer side where there are a lot of collaborative opportunities to businesses. And I think that's an interesting reason to adopt the cloud. Any thoughts on that from our panel? Jim, maybe we could start with you.
Well, there are security risks, which we can talk about, but in many respects, moving your data to the cloud, I mean, certainly, if you are not a good backer upper, if you don't have good sort of personal backup.
That's a technical term. Yeah.
I always say I do technology policy, not technology. But, why not take advantage of the economies of scale that are offered, include both on the security side? I mean, given all of the vulnerability of the consumer computer, of the personal computer, you can see huge benefits to getting the combined wisdom and expertise and staff and physical resources even of a cloud computing enterprise. There's the flexibility, there's the accessibility, the information is available from any device, the collaboration potential, obviously, I mean, the whole notion of sharing becomes much easier in the cloud context. From a sort of a CDT perspective, from a user perspective, there are interesting possibilities in terms of user control. I do think there is an interaction between the move towards the cloud and the move towards user-generated content. So, for example, if you look at like a YouTube, I mean, a YouTube, it combines both sort of the best of user-generated content and the best of a sharing. Somebody, I bet.
All right.
Talk about backup. See, you always want to have an extra energy supply available to your data center. So I think that from both the enterprise perspective and from the individual perspective, there are these significant advantages, which are the drivers that are moving people towards this, to embrace it.
Alan, do you have anything to add about shared security or ease of collaboration?
Well, first of all, I would say, you know, I think we've ticked off a lot of the ones from a user perspective. First of all, our perspective is that users are really driving this. It's not because they're being pushed into this model. I think they're choosing it for a lot of reasons, and they have a lot of choices out there. The Pew study, for example, just ticked off the same list I think that we've hit here, that from the consumer-based perspective, it was their top four reasons for adopting these applications were ease and convenience, number one. Number two, access from any device. Number three was ease of sharing. And the fourth was a risk aversion or a concern about security. And the statistics on, you know, personal security are not so great, right? I recently read that two-thirds of thumb drive, USB key drive users report losing the drive, right? I saw recently that 1 in 10 laptops are stolen within 18 months of their purchase. I saw that in a newspaper. I'm not sure if it's 100% true, but I think we all get the
you didn't read it in the cloud.
Let me just say, we all get the backer-upper problem, and I think we all know people who've had that experience. And so, at least for some users, they're going to choose these cloud-based applications to give somebody else the responsibility of protecting them against the virus, keeping their data secure. And there are these issues, and we need to make sure people are well informed about what's happening when they do that. But for many people, it's going to be a very rational choice. There are these other advantages, as we've said, about the utilization that happens in a data center that you can't get on a home computer or even a small corporate data center. Forbes had an article that talked about somewhere between a 10 and 15% of the average corporate data center's servers at any given time are largely outdated, obsolete, not being used well. A lot of these data centers are not being used at peak used all the time, so they're designed for peak capacity. They have a lot of slack capacity at any given moment. Again, so there's a lot of waste in that process. If you can outsource some of these applications to others who are building more efficient centers, there's going to be a huge there are energy savings components. There are a lot of benefits that come from that efficiency.
So maybe that's our first entry into the policy realm, which is to say with the trust that comes from putting your data with a third party and trusting them to secure it better than you can yourself, also obviously comes the risk, which is you're providing access to a third party to that data. It may be very limited access, it may be controlled access, but it's access nevertheless. And I think that's the rub for a lot of folks when they say, you know, do I want to store all of my data with Salesforce.com, my employer? Do I want to store my personal data on Google or in Microsoft? Applications that are web-based and so on. So, Jim, maybe you can say a couple of words and kick us off on a discussion of should we be doing that? Should we worry about it? And do we need to find policy-making ways to control access or regulate the folks who have the access?
I think this is the critical issue with cloud computing. And really, I would bifurcate it, just as an intro, I would bifurcate it into the sort of commercial use, reuse, sort of a terms of service kind of question. And here you have, of course, the factor of advertising. How do advertising-supported systems work? I would. The second major set of issues are the governmental access issues. So the best terms of service in the world, the best contract in the world, is going to yield, in some cases, to a mere subpoena. And as I always say, subpoena is Latin for no judge has ever approved this. So you can, certainly if you're a corporate enterprise, you're going to pay a lot of attention to that contract with your cloud computing service provider in terms of their responsibilities, their liability, both in terms of preserving your data as well as getting rid of your data once you end the contract, et cetera. And there's a whole host of issues associated with that. From the consumer perspective, that's in the terms of service. And again, big issue in terms of advertising and how this is supported and how the data might be looked at by the service provider. All of that sort of disappears when an FBI agent is standing in the lobby at the service provider's operation. And we have, up till now, had a largely speaking, a legal regime that is still, in a way, based upon possession and property. And in 1967, the Supreme Court said the Fourth Amendment protects people, not places. But in fact, some of the legal regime still says that what you keep on your laptop, fully protected, what you keep stored locally, fully protected. There's sort of a battle of the legal analogies for what happens when you take that and put it into the hands of a third party. And we can go into a lot more depth on that because I think it's a critical, critical issue and one that ultimately is going to require congressional action to resolve.
I think that's right. Alan, if I've adopted Google Apps and I'm using the word processing application, for example, and it's being stored remotely, and I just get web-based access to it, what assurances do I have that you're not providing unauthorized access to any third party, whether it's a government or a civil litigant or just someone else? How can I assure myself that my data is private?
Well, and I'll start by saying we know that that's a top concern of users, that their data is kept private and that it's not being used for purposes that they don't approve of. And so I think the starting point, as Jim says, is the contract that users have with their application providers. In our case, our approach is very simple, which is that users own their data. The intellectual property in that data is theirs. The data itself is theirs. We don't share it with other people. We give them control over how it's used, and we let them take it with them when they go. And that's the core of our promise to our users, and the trust of our users is critical, I think, for all of us in this space. If they don't trust these applications, they won't use them. So that's the starting point now, and it's going to be important for users to be informed about that. It's going to be important for consumer protection authorities, honestly, to be making sure that those promises are enforced and are transparent, and we take that responsibility as a company very seriously. I think the industry needs to as well. We do have this issue, which is the issue that Jim raised, which I think is squarely before us now, which is the issue of government access. And we can have the greatest terms of service and the best, and make all the promises in the world, but when a law enforcement agent arrives with a subpoena or appropriate authority, we obey the law, as we all should, right? And the question is, what are those standards? As Jim said, I think most users think, they've got to go get there's got to be a warrant, right? Judges got to be involved, and they think the standards are probably higher than they actually are. And we're very used to the model where there's a warrant, where a judge says, you know, there's probable cause to believe a crime has been or is being or is about to be committed, and that there are these process protections. So somebody comes to your house with the warrant, and you can say, you're looking for the other Alan Davidson, the known drug dealer down the street, not me, right? And what we face now is a world where those protections are not the same. And I think that will be a great surprise to many users, because it will not make sense to them that if the calendar or the picture or the checkbook that they keep on this laptop is protected one way, but that the second they use an application that puts any part of it somewhere else in the hands of a third party, all those Fourth Amendment protections disappear. That's not going to make sense to users. I don't think it comports with people's expectations of privacy in the digital age. And I think it is ripe now for people in the policy world to be thinking about this.
Jim, could you help us understand some of those standards, since I think you're probably most familiar with them?
Well, you know, we've got this, we have a law, we have the Fourth Amendment.
Thank goodness.
Thank goodness for that. Which protects people in their persons, houses, papers, and effects. There's pretty much no doubt that papers means digital stuff as well, so I don't think we have a problem there. But again, there has been this back and forth, which the courts have really not resolved at all, about the difference between the home, the office, the sort of person, the physical world, and the sort of virtual world. And Congress has began in 1986 with the Electronic Communications Privacy Act to address that, establish some technology-neutral rules. At the time, it was largely focused on communications and real-time communications. And the Congress said, before the courts could actually rule on the issue, Congress said that all of your communications, voice, data, wireline, wireless, regardless of technology, your sort of one-to-one communications were all entitled to the same high level of protection under the Federal Wiretap Act court order based upon probable cause. Minus notice, of course. I mean, the paradigmatic search still, you see on TV, you get the warrant, you go to the apartment, knock, knock, police open up, we have a warrant. If the bad guy doesn't open up, the police can knock down the door, but still they are required to show the warrant. As Alan said, if the warrant says 123 South Main Street and they're at 123 East Main Street, they're going to have to withdraw, they have to repair the door, et cetera. That's missing in the electronic world, that notice, because of the surreptitious nature of the surveillance. But what has happened since 1986, when Congress last addressed this issue, when you think about it, 1986 was before the World Wide Web, let alone before this massive trend to cloud computing. What has happened since then is so much more is stored. So we not only have ephemeral communications, but so much more of our communications ends up being stored, including quite probably increasingly our voice communications with the power of VoIP. And it is stored outside of the home, the office, the local device, etc. And right now, for example, when you're sitting in your office typing your email, and let's say it's on your screen, it's only on your local device, fully protected by the Fourth Amendment. When you push send and it goes over the wire, almost certainly protected by the Fourth Amendment, clearly protected by the Wiretap Act requiring a court order. What if you stop drafting the email and store it overnight? What happens if you store it on Gmail? Under the law as it now stands, that stored email, 100% protected on your computer, 100% protected while it passes the wire, falls into this category called remote computing service, which is available with a mere subpoena and delayed notice under current rule. Then when it gets to the intended recipient's box, it's under yet another standard. When it's 180 days old or more, it's under another standard. The Justice Department argues that as soon as you open and read it, it loses its warrant protection, et cetera. So right now we end up with this crazy quilt. If you go to the CDT website and dig down a little bit, you'll see our effort to try to map the crazy quilt of protections with different colors for high, low, and medium protection. It has absolutely no relevance to the way that users think of the technology. So the law has gotten completely out of whack with the way people use it. And as Alan was saying, the cloud computing services are designed to be seamless in the sense that there is not that much apparent difference to the user between the document you access online versus the document you store on your personal device. And increasingly, I think we'll have hybrid services, et cetera. But right now, the law, which was pretty darn good in 86 and mapped to the technology quite well at the time, has become a completely separated from the way that people, I think, view the technology and use the technology.
And just to chime in, you know, I would say it's not to say that this data is unprotected, right? And the law does provide protections, and in some cases, reasonably substantial protections. And certainly, in fact, companies that are involved in the cloud computing world were prohibited from turning over this information to governments without the appropriate authority. And we all take that responsibility really seriously. I think the problem in a lot of ways is that the standards are really not as high as they should be. And the law needs to be updated for the way that computing has changed. And so it's a great example of the kind of issue that comes up as we're making this move. And I think, as I said, I don't think this is what users expect either. And so there's some work to be done. And some of it may be statutory. Jim, I'm interested in your thoughts on how much of this is going to be achieved in the courts, whether that may be an avenue for dealing with this, because it doesn't really make right. I think it won't make sense to a lot of people.
Right. Well, and I would agree with all your comments. I think, you know, if you look over time, and again, I'm not a lawyer, right? I'm looking at it from a technology perspective, but if you look over time, when two or three decades ago, we were concerned whether software would even have the ability to be copyrighted. Right? And the legal system has caught up through a combination of industry working with the lawyers and with government regulators to determine what that needs to look like. And I think the same thing will happen over time with cloud-based computing, both for the consumer and for the enterprise. Microsoft just announced several different offerings. Some are commodity-based services. One is also a utility computing platform called Azure, very similar to most everybody in this space. We're in the space now, too. And the very first thing customers ask me when, let's say, they just want to go to a hosted exchange or hosted email model is, what guarantees can you give me? Right? Very similar, you know, so we have service-level agreements in place that say that we will not look at the data. That physically Microsoft will not look at the data, but also that their data is protected and there are financial remedies if they were to find out that something leaked. All those are great, right? But in reality, you know, it could also, I think it's going to be a combination of legal remedies, regulatory changes, as well as technology changes. So what happens, for example, and this has been an issue with just cell phones, how do you encrypt that data? Obama today, right, he got his BlackBerry from NSA, and they're encrypting that data, right, across the wire. So it's end-to-end encryption, too, that might be able to at least make people feel a little bit more comfortable. And that's just one instance of some of the technical things that might be able to help as the cloud industry matures. And I will say that we need to mature. I mean, we're at our very – I think the door just kind of opened. And I think as the technology matures, as the users and consumers mature with how they use it. So today I thought it was very interesting to listen to the CEO of Skype. He's sitting there saying, you know, and he pulls out all his devices, and this is all great. And so today, you know, we look at ourselves, and I have three computing devices in my bag right now, and they are connected to the Internet. What they don't do well is communicate. I can grab things. I can go to a site, and I can pull something down, but they don't all know about one another. Right? And they're not. And the reason they don't is because we don't trust, right, the sites to hold this data. So I think we will see a huge evolution over time, and I think that and it probably won't be as long as historical times. When we look, you know, it won't be two decades before we get these regulatory processes in place and the laws in place. It's going to be more on the tune of, you know, between 5 to 10 years.
That triggers just one quick thought, which is Susie sort of alluded to, which is we obviously we can't wait for Congress to resolve this issue and can't put all of our hope in Congress here, that as anything else, the sort of solution to the set of issues we're talking about has to do with, you know, user education and awareness, technology, design, and the possibilities of things like encryption, business practices in terms of the service and business sort of commitment to the principle of trust and the legal regulatory framework. So really, to get it right, we're going to need all four of those.
Should we even bring up the international component to this? Because, Jim, what I would note is the schema that you referred to is in the U.S. only, and so it protects U.S. citizens and resident aliens. And if you're a global user, as most Internet users are, you may not be similarly protected and you're under a different scheme, even though your communications may travel through the U.S.
Yeah, and I have to say this is one of the hardest issues because I honestly don't have an answer to it, but, you know, you've got all the questions of a U.K. order, and let's not even get to China, et cetera, but a U.K. order served on a U.K.-based employee for data that's stored in the United States or France or wherever, and you've got the U.K. order facing liability for not complying. You've got the U.S.-based officials possibly liable for complying if the U.K. order does not meet U.S. standards or vice versa. So, and, you know, people have been grappling with this trans-border jurisdictional issue on a host of issues for a long time now without a lot of clear resolution. A lot of this is worked out, of course, bilaterally between the governments. There are mechanisms. I honestly, at this point, I am not offering a solution on this one. It is one that we're going to
too hard.
Well, I mean, it is. It's not too hard, but very hard.
Well, and I think that what that's going to drive, the behavior that's going to drive, is as people try to push to go to the public cloud, what you're going to see is the private cloud instances grow. Right? So just for that in hybrid models where perhaps a service provider like Microsoft or Yahoo would offer a service but then allow that individual or that enterprise to choose where their data lives so that it stays, for example, in the United States at a particular data center. And I think you'll see those models kind of evolve until that is actually solved. From an international perspective,
I guess I would say the one thing that we do have to have clearly is we have to have sort of a broad commitment to rule of law on a global basis. And, you know, the China market, for example, is a market that nobody can ignore to some degree. On the other hand, we need, I think, a diplomatic effort by the U.S. government. Certainly we are urging the new administration to make human rights, again, a centerpiece of American diplomacy, and in some of these very nitty-gritty ways to raise the bar in terms of other countries so that there is a much better sort of equivalence. It won't be ever the same, but equivalence so that there can be some trust in a legal process coming out of other countries. And up till now, you know, people have said, oh, what can we do? It's China. And I think that's, we have to get away from that and begin really starting to make, Chinese and other countries go back to the concept of rule of law and the importance of that.
Alan, I don't know if you're prepared or able to share with us some of the ways Google has addressed these, because I know that they have, you know, met some of these cross-jurisdictional issues head on. Most of these matters are privately resolved and not talked about, but there may be a couple instances that you could share with us that are public.
I think Jim's actually summed it up pretty well, which is to say it's extremely difficult right now, and I think it's an issue that is going to need more work and resolution. For our U.S.-based services, we obey U.S. law. We do have localized products that obey local law, whether it's, our Google.fr, which obeys hate speech rules in France, or google.uk or google.jp or google.cn. And a lot of other people have taken, I think, a similar approach. But these jurisdictional problems are, I don't think we've seen the last of them at all. I think they're really just beginning, and it's going to be a very tricky area for all of us, not just in this area, but just in terms of all of the web-based services. And I'd say two things. One is we spent a lot of time talking about, you know, there's a category of issues that really come up with the hosting of data and the holding of data, storage of data, that are a lot of what we're talking about, and I think that arise less in some of these a provision of services or applications through the cloud. The second is I would also second what Jim said about the need for both industry to continue to devote itself to requiring rule of law and coming up with good standards for how it's going to deal with these kinds of issues. But we really do need the government's help in terms of dealing with this. I think Google in the last 12 months has been blocked. At least some of our services have been blocked in probably 10 to 12 countries. We're currently under a block where YouTube can't be seen in Turkey because of videos that were posted there. And we need help if we're going to make not just Google, but I think all the internet applications and services and content that's available need help if we're going to continue to let the internet be in a place where people around the world have access to information.
And I'll say, you know, I've spent the last 8 years criticizing the U.S. government on surveillance issues, but the fact is the U.S. government really has to lead on this issue. And, I am hopeful that this administration will sort of reassert that role. Mm-hmm. Because if you look around the world, I'm not sure there are other places where you will find the sort of sensitivity to both privacy and freedom of expression, particularly when it comes to vis-a-vis governmental controls that you have in the United States. And so,
Can you amplify that, Jim, by being a little bit more specific? I know you and I have had a couple discussions about whether we should regulate litigant access to data in the cloud, and I think that's an interesting topic and one I know you've got some energy and emotion around.
Well, litigant access, I mean, is something we haven't mentioned, but, prosecutors and FBI agents aren't the only ones who can issue subpoenas.
Right.
And we see, again, Google here facing a subpoena from Viacom for the transactional records associated with access to YouTube. And increasingly, again, the traditional rule is, and I believe should continue to be, that you come to the party in interest in a litigation. So you come to the creator of the document, you come to the creator of the information and get it from that person. So in a civil litigation, if it's relevant, I can be forced to copy the contents of my laptop. But now with cloud computing, the litigant has another place to go, and possibly someone who might not fight as hard to protect that information. And so we do have to have some rules associated with that. ECPA seems to prohibit civil litigant access to content of stored email. Ironically enough, it has nothing to say about civil litigant access to transactional data, which obviously can be extremely revealing and significant, but also can serve as a fishing expedition. So as we think about, again, in all of the forms of compelled disclosure, which is the issue here, you've got the sort of terms of service, et cetera. Every term of service you look at, of course, says, and of course we disclose your information in response to legitimate subpoenas, and some of them say, and other lawful requests, and some of them say, and otherwise in order to protect our interests or those of our users or third parties. So they sort of peter out in terms of how rigid they are. But all of them allow subpoena access. If you got a good term of service. And then the question is, what does it take in a civil litigation to do that? And I don't want to see any of these companies become sort of the honeypot that a litigator always goes to and says, give me everything you have on so-and-so.
And I think, you know, we don't want to either, of course, and which is why I think you've seen, I think the industry has a great incentive, and I think you'll see people really, I think, pushing back over on this over time. Google's had a history already of doing that. We had a fighting over broad subpoenas. We had one from the Justice Department in the context of civil litigation over COPPA. We had the Viacom example that Jim just cited, and we've pushed pretty hard on those. I think others in the industry will be doing the same. We all have this obligation, this desire to be good corporate citizens, to cooperate with law enforcement where appropriate, and where the rules, we need clear rules to tell us when to do that and how to do that. And the civil litigation context, I think we need more clarity in the rules as well. And I think we'll all welcome it. Our perspective, and I think a lot in the industry has been that the starting point for all of this is that, just as Jim said, that this should be the user involved should be involved in this, and that our initial position is always that you should be obtaining this information from the user, and the third party is the should be the last resort.
We only have a few minutes left, but I do want to ask if there are any questions from the audience, because I think we can prattle on for a long time about these topics, and we've covered the waterfront, I think. Yeah, please.
Sure. Well, I think, first of all, we do, I think the starting point is transparency and choice for users. And I think as a starting point, we do limit greatly how this information is used, how it's shared, never shared with people outside of Google. In the case of Gmail, it's probably the biggest example that people think of. And in fact, Gmail, we do, and I think users understand that we serve ads on the side of a Gmail message based on the contents of the Gmail message that's being shown on the screen at that time. And I think we welcome the chance to kind of work out with users what the standards for that ought to be. And I think right now there's a pretty competitive market around these products. And we have a user base that really likes our product and uses it. And if they don't, they have other places to go, which is great. That's how the market should work. And I do think there will need to be over time a lot of knowledge and clarity about how people are using data. We would welcome industry standards around some of this to make sure that people aren't being fooled about what's going on out there. I think it's going to be very important for trust.
Go ahead.
I'm going to ask you a question about Azure. Basically, what I'm thinking of, when I first heard of this from Ray Ozzie's description, I wasn't really convinced the software is needed for the software plus service is needed for the cloud. Yes, but when you look at what Google is doing with Chrome, you also see that it is quite obvious that perhaps the cloud will need a client. Yes, because if you need something, a software component on the client side. The implication there, of course, is that once you start having that, then Google's cloud will not interoperate with Amazon's cloud, which would mean that the definition of open would change to look at data as the open data portability. You would not no longer talk about open source or something like that, but you would have to. Even open clouds doesn't make any sense because that would be quite. The user won't care. The user would only care about the service, which what the cloud is all about. So, for the question is, do you think this vision would be? Because my vision then it seems to be that that Azure was right, but that was exactly probably the way it would go, and we will lose the definition. We'll change the definition of what is open.
So I'll start and then I'll pass it off to you. So. Let's. What he was saying is, does everybody know what Azure is? We announced
seconds,
this at
30 seconds.
So Azure is basically our Microsoft's cloud-based operating system. We announced it in alpha form at our professional developers conference this past October. So you can think of it easily as utility-based computing. So I want to go in, and I'm a great example of somebody, an enterprise customer, who's using not Azure, but this type of utility computing is NASDAQ. So NASDAQ is using Amazon's EC2 platform and their storage platform. And what they did is they said, you know what, we want to be able to provide a new service. There's no sensitive data in here, and it's going to take 100 different servers to provide this service. And what I want to do is basically dynamically have those servers be spun up, all the technology that I need, all the applications that I need spun up on those servers, and pay basically as I go and use those servers for that particular application. Right? It's much more cost effective. So Azure really is Microsoft's answer to that. It's our taking our Windows operating system along with everything on top of it and putting that in the cloud and making it more dynamic. Think of it a layer of abstraction over what we currently do on premise. So to your answer, it's an interesting. Today, I would agree with one piece is that we talk about cloud computing, but really you could call it sky computing with a bunch of different clouds, right? And the clouds kind of don't really communicate yet. Some of them do. You can stitch these things together today using data standards, interoperability standards that most all of the vendors do support. So for example, XML standards and the communications and standards that are out there. I think over time, to answer your question, I think it's all about choice. And so our position is that there is going to be no thick client that's required to access anything that lives in the cloud. It'll be about choice. You will have a thick client option. So whether it's mail using our Outlook or whether you want to use a web browser to access it, it's really going to be the consumer's choice and the enterprise's choice to how they implement that. So from your perspective, we're all about open, and we want to make sure that those standards are in place and that we follow the standards that are in place to be able to allow our users to have that capability.
It's good to hear that we're all for openness. And I think I'll just say, because I know we don't have a ton of time, that I think users are going to demand this, and educated users are going to be totally critical here. Users are going to need to understand that interoperability and open standards is going to be critical for the success of these businesses. And people should, as they begin to put data into the cloud, make sure they know how they're going to get it out. I will say Google as a company, deeply committed to the idea that when you have your mail with us, or whether you have your calendar with us, or your address book with us, you should be able to take that out and put it into any format that you want and move it to go somewhere else. And that notion of not locking people in that way, providing them and making sure that there are real open standards out there, truly open standards out there that different people can build to, is going to be really important for the success of this. And I'm optimistic. I think that users are going to get smart and they're going to demand it, and we'll all have to build it.
Yeah, you had a question.
Back in the beginning, it sounded like there was an element, when we were talking about definitions, it sounded like there was an element of assignment of risk or assignment of liability in a small business or somebody using cloud computing. And the example that came to my mind was, my question is, are there existing regulatory schemes that are incompatible with cloud computing? And the example I thought of was HIPAA. Could a doctor's office offload their responsibility to protect patient's data to a third party, to a cloud computing provider, or does HIPAA prevent that?
Well, I think if you're talking about the doctor outsourcing the clinical records in the hospital, from the doctor's office, the answer is no. I don't think that he could get out from under HIPAA by simply putting the records in the cloud. On the other hand, there is a set of cloud computing medical records applications, the personal health records applications, both Microsoft and Google have them, where to the extent that it is patient uploaded data, that falls outside of HIPAA because neither Google nor Microsoft are covered entities under HIPAA. To the extent that their products are used by doctors and that the doctor chooses as a way of facilitating patient access to the patient's records, to the extent the doctor uses a cloud service versus a local service, I think HIPAA covers both. It's the question of the whole PHR movement, which currently, by and large, falls outside of HIPAA. There's another complicated issue under HIPAA, which has to do with the whole business associate set of rules in terms of your third-party vendor is in some ways not directly liable under HIPAA. The covered entity, again, is the liable entity, and then it's just a contractual relationship with the third party. The long and short answer to it is there are some issues in the healthcare arena that are posed by changes in technology.
Real quick, I would just jump in to say, you know, I think it's a good example of like areas where you're going to have to think about how this new model of computing is impacted by regulations and vice versa. The other thing I was going to say, since we were talking about sort of the policy implications of this or policy barriers to all this, and Mike, since you really want to ask the question, I'd say the one other big policy area to think about here is the importance of broadband deployment for all of these applications to work well. A good connection to the internet is critical to being able to use these applications. It's partly why there's such a symbiotic relationship, I think, in terms of the incentives for deployment here of networks. We care deeply about making sure that people can get access to all of these services, and these services hopefully will be the things that, as we heard from the CEO of Skype, these will be the things that drive people's demand for those connections.
So maybe we'll take one more question all the way over here.
This past administration. So, one of the things that, but something you brought up seems relevant, and that is that you talked about Electronic Communications Privacy Act and remote computing service, and that's a concept that's been around for a long time, longer than 23 years, longer than the TCPA itself. But and that seems to be what we're talking about with all of these cloud computing services, and I don't like the term because it sounds like a corporate buzzword of cloud computing, but it's a compelling description because what sets these things apart, I think, is the fuzziness, the blurring of the lines between what is on your desktop or on your mobile device and what's out there and stored remotely. And that it's that blurring and the increase in bandwidth and decrease in latency has allowed us to have this illusion for users that something is stored somewhere else. I guess what my question in that is, how do you see that fact? Like, does that dictate our policy choices going forward? Do we pretend that do we have to treat everything as being stored on our desktop because we have that illusion? Or is your policy recommendation that we come up with do we treat it all as being stored remotely? Or do we come up with some sort of third way policy solution?
Now, I think the policy solution is to focus on the nature of the data and to have rules that are platform, technology, and business model neutral. So the content of a communication, the content of a document, should be fully protected under the Fourth Amendment, regardless of whether it is stored locally or remotely, whether it is accessed in transit or in storage, et cetera. And so content, I mean, the Fourth Amendment rule has traditionally been content is highly protected, transactional data less protected. Right now we've got a situation in which the same content is subject to three or four different standards depending upon where it's stored, whether it's stored, whether it's in transit. I think the user decisions as to when to use a cloud computing service, when to use a local service, should not come at the expense of the privacy and legal protections. That it should be all the other factors should drive that decision and that evolution. Right now, there is a privacy trade-off. I think that the law should eliminate that, and I think it should go to the higher standard, not the lower standard, because then otherwise we're denying ourselves the benefit of these technologies by saying, well, if you really want it to be protected, you have to keep it locally, and then by you lose so many benefits, we impede the development of the technology, et cetera. So I am proposing a consistent set of platform, technology, and business model neutral rules. Does that answer the question? You're 100% right that, I mean, ECBA, just 30 more seconds, ECBA has this remote computing service rule, but it's a subpoena standard, and that was before the days of true user controlled. That was, I take all my data, I give it to EDS, they process it, and they give it back to me. Now what I'm doing is I'm processing my own data on somebody else's server, and that is a big difference from 1986.
I want to thank our audience and the distinguished panel that we've had today, and I would be remiss if I didn't remind you that there are two more breakouts happening simultaneously and then a cocktail reception afterwards. So thank you for joining us today.